Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is must-hear radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. In business today, brand development is key to preserving margins and market share in this very competitive market. No one knows this more than our guest today, Liz Ehlert. Her background is really impressive. She has built the iconic brands that we all know of well, such as Victoria's Secret, Old Navy, and Gap. Her role as the senior most executive in charge of brand development for these high-profile brands got the attention of Target. They courted her heavily to bring this magic to them. After serving as a top executive Target, she moved on to build her own firm, Hello Mercer. She now leverages her extensive experience to help firms develop their brands. Today, we will learn insights about brand development and the types of teams needed to create the iconic brands most retailers can only dream of. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sarah.
Well, I'm so glad after all the scheduling problems, because you're such a busy gal, I am so glad that we were able to get together and do this interview.
I am delighted and look forward to speaking.
Well, you are an incredible lady. You have a very vast amount of experience in some pretty well-known brands and being a leader in the retail industry. But specifically, you've worked with Old Navy, Victoria's Secret, Gap, you were a leader in pink with Victoria's Secret, and then you also were an executive at Target. Can you give me a little bit of a background of kind of what your overall, I know you have so much experience, so it's hard to give you an overall experience, but what would you say in a few short sentences, what is a summary of what your background is?
I would say that my sort of key focus has been on the customer experience. And I think as it's evolved over time, those of us who've worked in creative channels have evolved with it. So I started off in sort of the brick and mortar side of the customer experience, working on store design, visual merchandising, creating windows and things that we touch and feel, and then really migrated to all the other channels that customers live in today. Social channels, online channels, et cetera.
So what do you mean by channels?
So channels being basically the real estate or the places that we live in. So we live online when we experience, shopping or socializing and communicating online. We live in stores and in 3D places. So channels are basically the places that we go and visit or shop.
So physical places or online place, virtual places, and
exactly.
Just the different places that, so what did you specifically do? I know you were at Old Navy when at the beginning of your career, when the place started, like literally
yep.
You were what, one of the first employees at Old Navy?
I was one of the first people in the creative circle, you might say. So how Old Navy began, it was really a white space opportunity that the then CEO, Mickey Drexler, who's now the CEO of J. Crew, envisioned for the Gap. While everyone was wearing Gap, he felt that he could bring that idea of sort of bringing style to everyone to a wider audience. And my role for Old Navy was working on a very, very small team. So the person that headed up Old Navy was Jenny Ming. And it was like a band of us that there were, 10 merchants and 5 creative people and 10 product people and a really, really tight organization, many of whom were schooled within the Gap organization.
Mm-hmm.
So they had those roots. But my particular role was as a merchandiser, visual merchandiser. So I was responsible to work with, product and merchandising and marketing and store design to communicate in store how the goods looked. So whether it was accessories or clothing or, we did all sorts of things with Old Navy. And I think what was amazing about it is because we were a pretty scrappy team and quite resourceful, there wasn't a lot of air between us as teammates. You know, we relied on each other, and we're very, very close to the business, but we also relied on each other for ideas and built on each other's ideas. It was a most amazing experience.
So that was the beginning of your career. So do you feel that you learned just a ton from that experience, and then you were able to kind of catapult yourself to your next big deal that you went on to?
Absolutely. I think in the Gap organization, they really teach you kind of the basic skills in merchandising and how to focus on product. And probably under the helm of Mickey Drexler, I think he's, you know, one of the greatest merchants ever. And in that particular company, anyone who's gone on outside of Gap in their careers usually has a product focus and really understands merchandising. I think by building on that, I was able to then work with Les Wexner and his team on looking at brands, not just from a product and a merchandising standpoint, but really as a brand. You know, he's an amazing brand.
For a lot of people who don't know who he is, he's probably a household name in that industry. Who is this person that you keep talking about?
Mickey Drexler or Les Wexner?
Yeah, tell us who both of these people are. I'm not really adverse in the retail industry, so you know, I've heard the names, but I don't really know.
Absolutely.
And I'd be, you know, to a lot of people who are listening, they probably aren't as familiar with the retail industry either. So who are these big wigs in the industry? What are they? Do they own the brand or what?
So Mickey Drexler was really a retail merchant prince. I think prior to coming to the Gap, he had been at Ann Taylor. And I think a department store before that. And he was brought on by the Fisher family, who owned the Gap. They started the Gap in the 1960s. And he was brought on, to really help shape, the Gap brand, and eventually, you know, took it from, I don't know if it was, you know, hundreds of millions to multi-billions within a pretty short amount of time.
So he was kind of the mastermind of Gap. You would say.
He was a mastermind. He was also the author of Old Navy, you know, and finding that white space.
And so
he also acquired Banana Republic along with, in his
that whole family.
His
so,
time.
So you got to work directly under him.
I worked, the CEO for Old Navy was Jenny Ming, and I had, my direct boss was Jody Petraka, another legend in kind of the creative field. But I should say that Mickey was highly involved with Old Navy. A, it was his brainchild, and he to this day, he still nurtures not only his direct team, but the extension of the teams beforehand. So many of us who have worked with him at close range or learned from him still are in contact with him. I mean, that's how good of a leader and a teacher he is and continues to be. And he, for those of you who, he's the CEO of J. Crew and has, you know, done, you know, miraculous things with that brand in the
last
several
years. So what is he like the Steve Jobs of the high-tech industry just in the retail?
I would say
you know, I'm trying to compare because I'm like,
yes,
okay.
Yes. I would say they're on par, certainly. And they were friends as well. I think they both sat on each other's boards. But he's that dedicated and that much of a leader in this industry. Absolutely. And then the second, you know, person that has been an incredible mentor to many of us that have worked for him or with him also at close range, was Les Wexner.
Yeah.
And he, started the Limited brand, also about the same time in the 60s, one store at a time called then the Limited, and went on to really become, sort of teach others how to acquire brands and how to leverage brands. So some of his brands that many of you are familiar with are, you know, Victoria's Secret, Bath and Body Works, Express, Henry Bendel. He bought that brand, I don't know, 20 years ago.
All the big brands that people don't even realize that all these brands are really tied together. And there's really kind of a main, is there a family that owns all of these?
You know, it depends. A lot of them are become public companies. Some companies, are private and they're privately owned. But many of these whether it's a private equity or one person that starts brands, they go public. And
but are they all connected? Were they all connected behind the scenes pretty much, or are they really separate entities?
They're often acquisitions. You know, so in the case of Les, he acquired the brands and then later sold them to private equity.
He acquired brands. Them, built them up into the what they are, and then sold them.
That's right. Yep.
Okay.
And so, you know, you asked me my learnings from Gap to, you know, what was built on to the next. And I would say I learned a lot about product and merchandising at Gap and the Limited. I learned about not only brand, but about duplication and expansion. Les is a really the mastermind in terms of building brands up and then figuring out how to get them to a very profitable place and then expanding them. He had a lesson, which is 1 to 3, 3 to 6, 6 to 12, meaning he would try something once. If it worked, he tried again. If it worked, he'd duplicate that. It was sort of a power of four, a power of three. And it was a great teaching model for those of us who watched him, because he was very measured in his approach to success. But once he saw that it was going to go, he would take risk, the right calculated risk, and multiply very quickly. And
so he tested the formula, the multiplication formula, in a very mm-hmm. methodical way. Then once he figured that the formula works, then he went kind of big with it.
Absolutely. Yep. He put his foot on the gas. And, you know, for those of us who saw that kind of expansion, so the Pink brand by Victoria's Secret was another brand that saw incredible growth very quickly.
And what did you do? What did you specifically do for Pink? Because isn't Pink relatively new?
It is. Pink is probably, gosh, maybe 8 or 9 years old. Okay. And it was kind of a white space opportunity that left.
What do you mean by white space opportunity?
He felt
I know
that
it's a common term in your industry, but you know.
Yeah. In the lingerie landscape, which is, you know, Les's key companies now are in lingerie and personal care. But for the lingerie business, which he dominated with Victoria's Secret, there was really no one coming close to him. He felt that there was more opportunity to leverage Victoria's Secret, and he thought that by bringing in kind of a college-age client and customer, that he could have a younger customer that grew into Victoria's Secret. And by doing so, it just expanded the brand's, you know, certainly the amount of stores we could have, but also the customer base. And so for him, he felt that there wasn't anyone in that market share that was doing a great job. So he had this idea, and he brought together those of us in what he called the center, which is, I guess it would be called a center of excellence, where different leaders, such as a product developer, a marketer, a visual merchandiser, store designer, all of us who have particular skills, would come and do one of two things. We'd either incubate brands like Pink, or we might reinvigorate brands that existed that were already good brands that he wanted to, you know,
so
change
what
or develop.
What was something that you came up with for Pink, or something that you came up with that was original and unique in some of these brands? Everybody sees when they're out there.
Yes. So I guess if you were to look at the dog and the polka dot, which are two very identifiable brand markers, those were, you know, two particular things in the Pink look and feel of the brand that I came up with, my team came up with. So
you came up with the dots and the dog that my daughter wears?
Yes. Yes.
So you guys did something right with Pink, because all these teenage girls, the only thing I don't like, and I got to tell you, but you probably had nothing to do with this, and because it's happened just recently, although you can correct me, are those darn bras are all padded. And so my 13-year-old girl looks like she's, I don't know, too well endowed.
Well,
why are they all padded now? I don't like that.
Well, I know there's, I'm sure, a reason why young girls try to look older, and it's a very saleable idea. And
I know, but it's painful
for us moms. I've heard that a lot.
It's too painful.
I know it. But Pink does very, very well, and they have an incredible, you know, leader of that business, Denise Landman, who was a merchant. She's a friend, someone we worked with very closely, and she's incredible.
Okay, so you did the dots, the dog. It. How else did you twist pink? Because, you know, it really, pink feels like it's part of Victoria's Secret. It really does feel like it's like a little outlet of Victoria's Secret. What else did you do? I know you had to leverage the brand because these girls just love Victoria's Secret. It's really big. Mm-hmm. What did you do that made it unique from Victoria's Secret to really get these young girls, which worked because I can't tell you how much it's one of the big brands that these girls wear. What did you do specifically? How did you excite people about it? And it probably, maybe you can give us a little bit of clue, you know, in a few sentences, what you did with Victoria's Secret as well to make it so big. I mean, it really is the brand.
Yeah. I think, first of all, there's sort of no I in these companies. I think, you know, we as a team, I was lucky enough to be able to sort of handpick a creative team that worked together well and took risks. So I would say instead of
everybody's working, it's a team. Were you the leader of the team?
I was the leader. Yep. I was the leader who helped, at least in the store experience, create pink. And I hired a really talented team. And, you know, various people went on to lead that team and are there today.
Well, you're so humble. You're so humble. And I know why you are, because so many people do so much work. And any leader knows it's the work of the people around you that make you good. And so much in this business world, people take credit for everything. And it just doesn't work that way. And so it's kind of refreshing. It is refreshing to see you be so humble about this. But you really led those groups to create the imagery behind pink and Victoria's Secret and stuff.
I was very lucky to be able to play that role. And I should say for Victoria's Secret, I mean, Victoria's Secret, before I ever came to The Limited, was so well established. And, you know, their chief marketing officer, Ed Razick, is sort of legendary as well and came up with leveraging the brand through the very famous Victoria's Secret fashion show and so forth. But I would say the impact that I helped create within that company and with my team was not only to differentiate each space. So for pink, it was doing more of what felt different by leveraging some of the key things that worked for Victoria's Secret, which were the businesses, their key focuses are really bras and panties. But what we were able to do was create a space that felt totally unique. And by doing that, it helped separate then what Victoria's Secret, which is, you know, it's a sexier brand. It's more mature in it's more luxurious. It's, has more fashion. It's more, you know, there's a lot about it that we were able to go in and look at and bring out. So the use of lace and silks and, you know, beautiful dark woods and, you know, all the things that we use in the store design, but also leveraging the supermodels. I mean, that's really the icon of, you know, the Victoria's Secret brand are, Ed Razick's, you know, excellent play on using the supermodels.
How much were you involved in some of the fashion shows and bringing them into the stores and so forth?
Definitely in the stores, we worked hand in hand with Ed's team, but I have to say the fashion shows are really, they're almost their own business in a way, or their own creation. So those started, gosh, I don't know how many years ago, maybe 15 years ago. And, they started off as an idea and then they became this sort of coveted event. And, we usually bring in a whole group of people, that work in them. And I definitely had, you know, parts to play in them, but they were led, you know, chiefly by Ed Razick. And, I think there's, you know, an excellent team that he's always had working on them.
Did you have input in the sense that since you were responsible for the way the stores all looked, did you give them input on what you wanted to maybe take from those so that you could directly sell something in the store? Like say, hey, I know this sells well, this kind of look. Can you please have them wear this in the, you know?
I would say we were all a connected team. So Sharon Turney, who's the CEO of Victoria's Secret, an excellent CEO. I would say her chief job is sort of connecting those dots. So to answer your question, if we were going after, say, an emerging fashion trend, it would definitely show up in the fashion shows. It would show up in the marketing. It would show up in the materials in the store. So we were all sort of a fluid group that worked off of sort of emerging trends. And I think that's the best way to describe it versus one person did one particular thing. Yes, we would execute against our discipline, but we were all very connected. And I think a good CEO makes sure of that. And we did that, I think, very well at Victoria's Secret. And I think it shows in the customer experience across all the channels. You know, they're using supermodels online to communicate the brand. The fashion show is televised. Store experiences, you can smell it, you can touch it, you can feel it, you can hear it. And I think that's when a brand is working, you know, the best is when really all of your senses are absorbed.
Well, it's pretty much the leader, right? Every other store now tries to follow, emulate them to try to get sales. It's what it feels like to me as a female shopper that Victoria's Secret pretty much is leading the way.
I think they are absolutely a market leader. Yes. Yeah. There are others that do, I think, an incredible job, very different from Victoria's Secret, but they all have some things in common.
But they're niche. Wouldn't you say they're niche markets versus mass?
Well, I think about, yes, perhaps. But I think about J. Crew, you know, as an example. Again, Mickey Drexler came into that world. And while it is more niche, I don't know how mass it is. I think that his sort of special skill is taking a very editorial idea and making it available to a lot of people.
But they, does J. Crew sell undergarments?
Oh, no, not in their... in their segment, you mean for lingerie? Yes. Yeah. There's no, I don't think there's anyone close to Victoria's Secret. Absolutely.
That's what I mean. In lingerie, they are by far the leader.
By far. Yes.
Well, okay. So with all your background and your superstar status in this industry, Target went after you pretty hard, didn't they? That's what I hear. Can you tell me, what that experience, what happened? How'd you get into Target and what were you supposed to do for Target and kind of go from there?
I will. It's an interesting story. I'd always wanted to work for Target. Coming from Minneapolis and even though I lived on the coast for most of my career. And it wasn't until I came back here as, a consultant to raise, you know, our daughter. And, I was called in by the marketing department, and specifically I met with a couple of guys that I knew from, you know, my old Navy career and so forth. But I met with Michael Francis, who was their longstanding CMO and, you know, really a maverick in the marketing space. And I met with him and we talked about me coming on board as the head of creative. And pretty quickly, I was brought in. And the odd thing that happened is it was right at the time when the JCPenney sort of transformation was happening. And Michael ended up leaving the day I started, which is a very odd way to start a job. And by 10 o'clock that morning, I was reporting into the CEO. And it was such a vast cultural difference from any, you know, place
from going
that I kind of
to
worked.
A fast-paced East Coast environment to Target.
Yes.
Very, almost a culture shock, right?
It was. And I learned, you know, in hindsight, I learned more from Target, I think, than almost any other experience, simply because it was so different. As I said, the pace, the culture, the scale, you know, of
Target's huge, right? Target is in the top 10 largest companies or retail companies, shall I say, in the world.
It is. And it's, you know, I have a lot to thank people there for. I mean, at first I felt, you know, how you go into a job and you work, it's sort of like going to a new country and you don't speak the language. And so I would come home at like 7 or 8 o'clock at night and I would be exhausted.
Oh yeah. Your brain hurts for a while.
I couldn't figure out why this was happening because I'm a very high energy person. And I realized, just the sheer number of people that I was meeting. So my role there, was to oversee the in-house creative team as well as, a group of what they called visioneers, or really they were, you know, sort of directors who oversaw different businesses. So whether it was brand or fashion collaborations or, home product or beauty. And so each of those businesses, you know, typically when someone goes to a retail company, they're dealing with a company, if they're lucky, in the hundreds of millions. This was, you know, in the tens of billions. So imagine, how vast each, each the players were of each decision, but also how long those decisions took to make. And so I had never worked in a company that needed to take the amount of time that it did, to make decisions, because if you make the wrong one and you're sitting on a $70 or $80 billion company, the wrong one can go really wrong. And if it's the right one, it can go really right.
Well, maybe they should have learned, they could have learned from your process where they do it at a micro level. And then I suppose you can't do everything at a micro level and then see if the thing works and then expand it out.
But, I mean, I think they're now looking, I mean, it certainly doesn't have anything to do with me, but, I would say in general, because of, you know, a lot of the things that Target has experienced recently, I think they are looking at ways to innovate and make decisions more quickly. I just think when you get to be, you know, have hundreds of thousands of employees, I don't know how many thousands of employees they have, each decision has a compound effect. So, for me culturally, you know, I definitely felt, you know, my speed and how quickly I'd moved in the past probably, you know, wasn't a fit for sure. In the way they used to work.
Well, it's interesting.
More quickly.
It's interesting because I worked for US West back in the day, which was a spinoff of AT&T when the AT&T was broken up. US West was one of the baby bells. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge company as well. It was a Fortune 100 company. And, yep. You know, a project, they had $1 billion set aside to redo all their systems at the time. And, you know, they spent just a ton of money doing things, but they had to innovate. That was when the internet was really taking off and they needed to get in the forefront of that. And they had 75% of the internet market at that time, or the internet, they're managing 75% of it. And so they were doing something right, but they had to figure out in a old world environment, much like Target, how to innovate quickly. And the way they got around that was to create, they handpicked people, and I was one of the ones that they handpicked, to put into this division, and then they insulated us from everything to try to innovate and create this, it was a networking company, it was called Enterprise at the time, and it was the whole internet branch of US West, and to incubate this thing, and they tried to keep us away from the rest of the company so that we could be entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
And, you know, it reminds me of what Target probably, what their problems are, is because it's so hard. Everything is so entrenched, but they need to be a very stable, the rest of the company needed to be a very stable company. They plod along almost like the government. They have so many customers they need to serve. They needed it needed to be a very stable environment. And I would think Target was, there is the same way, but yet with the whole industry changing so fast with the internet, it's just changing everything.
It is. I think you you're hit on something that's really important. I think the companies that sort of stand still and think yesterday will work tomorrow and aren't finding ways, really scrappy, if you will, innovative ways, to change the dial, I think they're going to be in real trouble. I mean, one of the things I didn't touch upon working for the limited brands is, my role within that group was working in the centers I talked about, but part of the beauty of how Les works and how he thinks is, you know, he knew that if he just tried to solve something an inch at a time, that nothing would move as quickly as his vision wanted it to, you know, to go. So he did take a group of people, and that's not really how Pink and VSX, which is a sport brand within the lingerie brand, those businesses took off very quickly because he did take, you know, sort of a band of people that were very good at what they did. However, he would take us out of the mainstream part of the business. The business leaders of the business units at times, you know, were sort of like, how can they, you know, go off and do all this and we have to still, you know, hit our open to buys and follow through and keep our budgets down. So there is that tension.
Oh, yes.
I remember that too.
Yep. I remember that. Yep.
But I think any good brand, any successful brand has some way of moving circles of innovation throughout their company and then leveraging the learnings and moving. And I have to believe Target is, is rethinking a lot.
They have to do that in order to get there. They have to. The I teach a class at the university at the Carlson School, and we talk a lot, or I talk a lot about culture and the importance of culture, and then we also talk about the different types of companies and innovative companies and stable companies and all these things, and it really it's really important to create a culture that's innovative and can move quickly with the way the new environment is. It's just,
I agree with you. I was reading recently, I mean, Michael Kors has been in the paper a lot, his success and how can they duplicate that and so forth. And fascinating about that study is, I think there's, a lot of reasons he's successful. I think his exposure, I think his ability to sort of trade up on luxury into kind of the mass. And most importantly, it's the team, it's the fact that you have him as a person, a designer. But you also have operators and people that are stable, stabilizing the business. And I think it's a fascinating case study because in order to innovate, you have to have the other side of it, which is like who's minding, how we're going to execute and how we're going to, leverage what we have and this year, next year, and the next 10 years. So it's fascinating in terms of a culture of what makes success, because without that innovation and the ability to risk and differentiate, it's a very competitive market. But if you don't have the stability side, at some point you're going to sort of burn out. It's one example that I think is an excellent study.
Well, how much do you, there's a lot of stores that are closing. A lot of brick and mortar stores are shutting their doors over the last few years. And there's plans for a lot of them closing. Like Juicy Couture is closing 70. Coach is closing 70. Barnes and Noble is 20. There's just a lot of different, Abercrombie and Fitch is closing 180. Lots of stores are closing. Target's closing 12. How much of this do you believe is the economy versus just the markets changing?
I think that, and it's probably both, but I would say if you look at really successful brands, they're looking for more spaces. So if you look at like a Tory Burch or, they're brands that are investing in the customer experience, investing in brand differentiation. They tend to look for, channels to expand in, how are they reaching their customer? And brick and mortar is alive and well for those brands. And they want to expand, particularly internationally. But if you take a look at Coach, a legendary brand and why they would be closing, I mean, part of what I think is interesting is a large portion of their business is in wholesale. And if you are a retailer and you become a wholesaler on the upside, you think, wow, everyone wants my brand. Isn't that great? But at some point, it's a slippery slide because if you're wholesaling, you sort of become this ubiquitous for everybody brand. And then if you make a wrong turn or someone else is sort of eating your lunch in a creative space, then all of a sudden you have great exposure and you're not able to turn that trend. And it's really, really tough when you get at that scale.
So part of that is maybe protecting their
brand.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause they sell the Neiman Marcus and all these other stores. Right. And so if they're selling, they have their own brick and mortar stores and they're selling to Bloomingdale's and Macy's and all these other places, mm-hmm. it really kind of, it's hard, right? They're competing with the people who they're with their customers.
They are competing with their customers, and I think people are fickle. I think with fashion is a funny place today. I mean, you can throw on a $5 pair of vintage trousers from the thrift store and in a great new handbag, and I mean everyone, at every level is mixing high and low. And I think that whole notion of being able to choose where you shop and how you look, I don't know anyone at all these days who's sort of dressing, head to toe in a particular look or a particular brand, which makes the idea of branding and focusing on creating customers that almost become part of your tribe or part of your brand, making them more loyal matters all the more. So if you're not exciting them and bringing new ideas to the table, inviting them into your brand in new ways, someone else will. And so it's very, very tricky.
How do you reinvigorate your brand when it starts to go downhill? Like like Abercrombie and Fitch, I would think they were just huge. I don't know how many years ago. You get old because you remember them being super huge, mm-hmm. and then all the controversy and all their commercials and stuff with these kids dressed, not wearing much clothes and things. Yep. But you just don't hear about them like you used to. You know, so how do they reinvigorate? How do you reinvigorate brands? Because I know that's something that your company does and helps people do, mm-hmm. or I think it is what you do.
It's part of what I do. Part of it is, you know, helping reinvigorate. Sometimes it's just going and helping in a channel and, you know, making the creative teams come together. But, in a case like Abercrombie and Fitch, and, you know, I respect Mike Jeffries. I never worked for him. But I think, you know, at the time, again, he was, you know, in partnership with Les Wexner. He was one of Les's brands. You know, they served a certain purpose, and they were the thought leaders around this sort of young college hip look, as you've talked about. And when other people, American Eagle, Gap, who knows, there's many people that play in that field of sort of t-shirts and denim. It's what every American teenager wears. At one point, he was doing everything better than everybody else. The quality of the clothing, the store experience, the labeling, everything about it was unique. And when other people started to basically utilize his platform and do it for half the money, you know, a fickle 16-year-old moved court. And so I think what Abercrombie's left with is we either have to change with the customer and do what we do really well, same mind, you know, good branding, good product, good ideas, good experience, and start doing it in a way that is unique because everyone else has taken their position, or they have to get out. It's one or the other, because they're not going to necessarily stop being good at what they're doing, but they have to continue to carve a unique niche. It's very difficult to keep upending when you're top of the game. How do you do that better than everybody else?
Well, you can't stay. I mean, you can't stay at the top forever. I mean, you stay at the top, you get to the top, and then you create your niche, and then you try to keep your customer base, right? I mean, because or maybe you can get back into the top every 15 years or something, but I just can't see how you could, with the way everybody's so fickle, it would be impossible to stay at the top that long.
It's really, really difficult. I mean, if you took like a luxury brand like Chanel, you know, which one arguably they've never been at the bottom, but you know, you take someone like a Karl Lagerfeld who keeps finding ways to reinvigorate and up himself, if you will.
But he's not like mass oriented. Do you know what I'm saying? Like even though he's big, he's not like. Just capturing it all kind of thing.
Right. And it's a much narrower market, but I use him as an example, to say even in mass market, people who stand out in the marketplace, whatever level they're at, and become, you know, super differentiated, it is very difficult, but it's the only way they can continue, as you said, to sort of buoy up and continue rising. I mean, I take a look at the Gap, you know, the great Gap brand. That one we've seen ride, you know, its ups and downs. And, you know, arguably no one had their positioning in the 80s. No one did cool like the Gap, you know.
Yeah, I remember style forever. That.
And then a lot of people did. And then even some of our own companies within the organization, Old Navy and Banana and Gap, started to look similar. So to your point, in a mass level, it's very difficult to look, you know, completely unique from your neighbor, because someone's going to knock you off, you know, very quickly and start selling exactly what you're selling. But I do think the best creatives in the business and the best merchants find a way to do that.
And then they create a niche that just works. It can work, right? You know what I'm saying? They have this niche that they can keep their customers, a customer base that'll stay with them.
Yeah. I think of like even a company like Converse, and while, you know, I don't know how big Converse is, but they seem, you know, like sort of, you know, everybody has a pair of Converse, you know, it's probably one of, you know, the things that show up in everyone's kid's closet or adult closets for that matter. And they're a brand that, you know, leverages a very simple particular shoe shape and finds ways to keep reinvigorating who it is. And it's usually through collaborations. It's through, you know, some, you know, new innovation. It doesn't have to be a total transformation, but they're an interesting brand to watch because there's small iterative moves that a brand can make that just keeps people coming back for more. And so with Abercrombie, you know, I really think, you know, they do certain things better than anyone else. So I would probably focus on those key core things in their brand equity and find ways to make them stand out and be a little bit better than everyone else. And I think if there's a company that can do it in that space, it's Abercrombie.
Well, what do you think is the next big thing? What's the game changer in retail?
Well, I mean, I think the fact that we can shop anywhere, anytime on our phone is the biggest game changer. I think those who are able to market to us in a way that really sort of captures who we are and makes our shopping experience bespoke is the game changer. I think that and probably the ability to share what you're doing when you're doing something with other people in social media and creating earned media by doing that, I'd say those two things are probably the biggest game changers for sure.
So how do you incorporate social media into bottom line numbers?
I think for a lot of people, it's hard to say because we did this, this is what happened. But you know, there's obviously a lot of people out there that are, you know, covering how much traffic each site is getting and how many mentions and who's blogging and so forth and so on. And at the end of the day, I would say you can measure brand affinity. So if you know a lot of people are talking about the brand, a lot of people are wearing it, you know, without saying, I know that because we're being talked about this much, it adds this much to the bottom line. I have to believe there is, and you would know this better than I do, Sarah, teaching a business class, but there is a pattern and a trend in terms of how interested and how aware people are of your brand and how often they're admiring and involved in your brand to the sales and to the desirability of your brand.
You create demand and the culture makes a huge...
Exactly.
Everything's culture, right? And so...
Exactly.
You have to figure out how to, I don't know, plant the seeds of the culture of your brand. But it's hard. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it is hard. I see brands sometimes saying, we need to hire a blogger. We need to cover social media. And what it tells me is they don't really understand the brand. So to me, a brand is a conversation. It's a story. And to the extent that you have people in the brand that understand that story, are able to communicate it, and your customers become part of that story, those are the brands that I think become living things. And they expand organically.
Well, and I think the most powerful uses of social media is to get the leaders of mm-hmm. social groups to be starting to spread the word.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's figuring out who they are, figuring out how to influence them to use your brand. It's interesting because it's changing how marketing is doing in general. Getting these kids to do something and still be ethical about it, right?
Yes.
Because you have to always question yourself. I just taught a class today on ethics, and what questions do you ask yourself to know that you're operating ethically? You don't want to pay off a 15-year-old to talk about your brand necessarily. Well, maybe you do, but you got to do it in an ethical way.
Yeah, I think if a brand, I mean, I've been lucky to work for brands with, I think, really high integrity. And it doesn't always mean, you know, you make the right move and, you know, you hire bloggers, you hire people that you want to enhance your brand. But I think if you have the idea that you're creating a brand that people want to be part of,
exactly.
That there's sort of a natural way to have people come to you.
You create that culture.
And it's because that we are, you know, as creative leaders, as retail leaders, we are looking at how customers behave and not forcing them to behave the way we want them to, but that we invite them to behave the way they will in the brand that we're working on. And
this is what you're an expert at. And that's what, I mean, it's so hard. Most people don't understand how to do that because culture is so powerful. Telling that story and having your brand, it's all subconscious, right? And people don't even know it's affecting them. And you're so good at that. So go ahead.
I was going to say, the older I get in terms of just understanding new ways to experience creative and brand and customer, I kind of feel like the less expert any of us are, you know? And I think that's what makes
that's kind
of
true. Yeah, that's funny. That's a wise statement.
I feel like a beginner in many ways. And I can honestly say I think I am, you know, because I look at my daughter's way of communicating and shopping and thinking and, you know, talking. And it's a completely different way, you know, than any of our, you know, of the rest of the generations and so on and so on. So we do become beginners if we're good listeners and we're champions of change, so to speak. And I definitely am.
So it's important to understand so I think building on that, it's important to understand the framework of breeding creativity and breeding the environment. So that the people that understand the current culture or understand the dynamics can then help with the growth of the brand. Right? I mean, it's creating that management framework so it works.
I think it is critical. If you have, you know, a place where you have, I think, diverse talent and, you know, if you're lucky enough, I've been lucky in my career to be able to surround myself with people that are a lot better than I am at any particular thing, really anything's possible, you know, and if you nurture that environment and you allow people to take risks and, you know, I feel like I've been so lucky, you know, my mentors and my supervisors have, you know, they had faith in me and the teams that I was able to help build. And we took a lot of risks. And, you know, sometimes we didn't make the right decisions, but a lot of times we learned a lot and we had a lot of fun doing it. It is the way to create a successful culture. And I have worked in companies where people are fearful and they're trying to just do what they did last year and hope, you know, hope it works. And, it's an impossible way to lead change when that is the, you know, the way that people think. I think it has to be open and a culture that nurtures.
The culture is so important. It's all about the culture, I think, because if you don't have, that's my class, not today, but the last class I had was about culture. And I just think it's passion is important and culture is important. And I just agree with you so much. What is next for your company? What are you doing with your company? Hello Mercer, right? Hello Mercer is your company, which is a cool name.
Mercer.
That's cool. What are you doing with how are you helping companies in this new market space? This new competitive, challenging, high tech, the world's changing market?
I would say, honestly, my company does a few different things, but in essence, it's looking at the ecosystem or the way that customers show up in all these different channels and making sure the ideas, the people, the strategy, and the execution all work together. So whether it's a tiny company, you know, $100 million, $20, $50 million company of, you know, product people and merchants and designers and marketers and visual people, instead of them working in silos, it's how do we take ideas that create assets and a conversation that can be used across all the channels? And when that happens, it not only connects the internal teams, but it obviously connects the customer to the brand. So that's what my company does, in almost each instance to a larger, you know, or lesser large degree. Sometimes they need, you know, one aspect of their company or the talent to get connected or, you know, to work better. But mostly it's to connect all the teams that need to work together.
I think you will have a lot of work going forward with there's so much change. I suppose there's always been change, but I feel that today's retail market really is being bombarded with the Amazon. Are people worried about the internet and how to actually use it?
In which way?
Well,
retailers, old school retailers?
Yeah, I mean, how much is Amazon and that whole concept? I would think that a certain amount of stuff won't be hurt because you need to be able to try things on. You need to be able to touch and feel it. Mm-hmm. But am I right with that? I mean,
I would say, you know, between Amazon and Google, I think between those two guys, a lot of brick and mortar retailers, are very nervous about what it means to their business. Because, you know, with free shipping and sort of a no, you don't have to leave your home type of experience.
Exactly.
To get everything from, you know, dog food to, you know, an Hermes bag if you need one. You know, it's a scary proposition. But I think because we're human beings and we need to be physical and we need to touch things and we need to see things. And there's that aspect of who we are as human beings. I do think that most of us, almost all of us, like to have choices in where we go and how we do things. But I don't think human beings are going to be left in a box to live their life. They still have to eat and meet people and try things on and,
well, yeah,
and have the entertainment.
Go,
yeah.
You have to try stuff on. I'm not going to buy a pair of pants off the internet. I know that,
right.
I have to try on so many of them just to look good in one.
Yeah.
But so the chance of me buying one off the internet that looks good on my behind is not very high. Right? I mean, come on. So
I think it's a mixture. And I think the brands that are doing it well are investing more actually in their customer experience at a brick and mortar level because they want to bring theater back into the experience so that they create brand affinity, so that if that person who loves their brand already wants to buy it on the internet, they're glued to the brand because they have both experiences to choose from.
Well, and that makes sense.
I mean, Apple's a great idea.
Once you understand your size and what you, with that particular brand, then you can order it.
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean,
tying that together.
I was going to talk about the Apple stores. You know, we all know that, look, it's a computer. It's not that we have to try it on. It doesn't have to look good with the shoes we bought or the makeup. You know, it's a machine. But when you go into the Apple stores, because of the experience, because of almost the social experience, as much as just, you know, going into those beautiful stores.
On the Apple stores. The Apple stores always packed.
They're packed. And of any company that doesn't, in a way, really even need to have stores, you know, you could sort of, it's a computer. They do,
exactly.
I think, the best job of connecting the planet with, you know, with all their channels and the ways they serve the customer. So it's a very interesting idea. So to your point, if you're trying on something as, you know, emotional as a pair of jeans or sandals or shoes or makeup, of course, you know, we want to go and look at that and touch and feel and see. So I don't think stores are going away. I think we need to be a lot smarter in how we engage the customer.
Well, I thought it was interesting. I was in Target yesterday with my daughter, and they are offering a certain set of products, you know, like different food products, toilet paper, commodity type products that they'll deliver for free to your house. You order it online and they deliver it for free. And I thought that was interesting. So they're trying to, with stuff that's commodities, they're trying to change their you know, how they do things.
Yeah. I don't know how that's going to work. I mean, I think they're trying to sort of, you know, take a look at Amazon as competition and say, how are we relevant? I imagine, you know, the same Amazon is thinking, what if we did brick and mortar? How would we do that?
I'm sure.
So I think they should swap some of their folks and say, let's school each other on brick and mortar and I'll school you on direct marketing, you know, and it'd be a very fascinating conversation.
Yeah. Well, it's just everything's changing. And the next generation is so used to being online that they won't need the touch and feel as much as we do.
I don't know. I think it goes in waves. I think, again, because of, you know, how people experience life, they need different experiences. I mean, there's all sorts of people that sort of go tech-free for vacations now and weekends and so forth because they want to get back to looking at someone in the eye and reading a book in their hand and being outside. And so I think it's choices. And even for our kids, I don't think they'll ever want to replace, you know, certain kinds of experiences with an online experience. I think they want both.
Well, I agree. My kids go, and like I said, with clothes, they and shopping in general with my daughter, they want to go touch and feel and be part of that whole experience. And I can't see that going away.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
Okay, well, good. Well, thank you so much, Liz. And I'm going to include all your information or all your contact information on the show's site. So if anybody wants to get hold of you or learn more about you, they can get to your website. And I just thank you so much for joining us today.
Sarah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye. Are you still there?
I am.
Okay. That went really good.
It did. I'm sure I was like...
Building a hot brand is more about creating the right team environment where creativity and innovation can thrive. Leadership is key. It's not just about having good ideas. You need a great culture where a constant stream of ideas can flow. This may mean you need to upgrade your management style, change your environment, and lead by inspiring innovation. Can you do this? Old style managers just won't do. The challenge is to embrace an environment you may not be used to. Change may have to start with you for it to work. It doesn't mean you abandon quality and all the other trademarks of good business. Hopefully this gives you a lot to think about. That's it for now. Have a wonderful day.